On tech news today, online retail giant Alibaba filed for an IPO. We'll tell you why that's really big news. And an internet radio service launches as a social network. And finally, a partnership between LinkedIn and Evernote transforms what you can do with your business cards. All that and more coming up right now on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, May 7th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today is Alexis Madrigal. Alexis is a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees the technology channel, and he's also a visiting scholar at the University of California, Berkeley, in the Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society, not to leave society out there. Welcome, Alexis. Glad to have you on. I've been reading your stuff for a long time, and it's a thrill for me to have you on the show as our guest co-anchor. Well, today is an important day in the world of technology. It's World Password Day. That's right. Change is in the air. It's time to change your frickin' password. Or better yet, embrace a password manager like LastPass. Now, this password day, it was created by Intel as a publicity stunt, but a good one. It's a initiative to get people to think about creating better passwords and use better password management. And it's very, very important. Last year, over 1 million people changed their passwords, or I guess the correct statistic is that 1 million passwords were changed. So is either 1 million people each with one password, or one person with 1 million passwords, or somewhere in between. Anyway, there's going to be a lot more people changing their passwords this year, thanks to the likes of all the hack attacks and Heartbleed and all of that stuff that's been happening lately. Well, let's get right into the news. LinkedIn and Evernote are partnering on putting business cards to work. The partnership enables you to take a picture of a business card using the Evernote app on your smartphone, which makes the data on that card searchable and viewable on both Evernote and LinkedIn. Zach Hall writes for 9to5Mac, and he's here with us to explain this new partnership. Welcome, Zach.
Hey there. Thanks for having me again.
It's our pleasure. So what happened to LinkedIn's business card scanning app, which I believe was called Card Munch?
Yeah, they bought Card Munch in 2011, in early 2011, and then put it out again in late 2011. And at the time, it was really hot. It was like the coolest thing to have on your iPhone. You know, you can easily scan someone's business card and catch their contact information. But under LinkedIn, it really didn't grow a whole lot. It was kind of hit the back door. And this past winter, Evernote released their own version of that same idea, but better implemented, and with a premium subscription fee behind it. And part of LinkedIn's new strategy is to partner with companies that do good things rather than try to copy them themselves and maintain it and focus on just their primary service. And so it's going to be part of the Card Munch goes away, and then Evernote will replace it. Users will get a couple of years for free if they use it, or 1 year for free if they didn't use the old app. But I think it's really a win-win for both Evernote and LinkedIn, unless you're just really a fan of the old app.
And one of the big differences, of course, is that Card Munch was human-powered using the Mechanical Turk. And the new LinkedIn and Evernote partnership uses Evernote's machine recognition instead of human beings. So people have been cut out of this process altogether, other than the people that you meet and have exchanged business cards with. Now, can you take us through how this process works? So I meet somebody in a business setting and I get their business card. What do I do with the business card exactly?
Well, the idea is you've always got your smartphone on you, so you can scan their business card and it intelligently can, you know, analyze that and catch their name and, you know, just the general contact information that you would do manually, like their phone number and email address. And it's not a new idea, but LinkedIn partnering with Evernote is new in that it kind of says, you know, you had a better version of the same thing that we had. And it's, you know, what caught my attention was that it's really it shows LinkedIn's strategy of partnering rather than building something competing that's kind of inferior.
I mean, do they need the partnership? I mean, the technology is one issue, and Evernote has good technology for scanning images. There's no question about that. But isn't that something that could be acquired or developed by LinkedIn? After all, they have about 300 million users, and Evernote only has about 75 million users, and I'm sure there's enormous overlap there. So they really don't need Evernote's promotion in terms of the user base. Is this technology so rare or difficult to come by that they need to do this partnership?
I think it's part of a greater strategy of saying that we're focusing on our LinkedIn product, you know, the thing that you know as LinkedIn, you know, profiles and networking, and leaving the other kind of things that you may consider a hobby, you know, to other companies. They noted in their article that they've got partnerships with Apple. You know, they're integrated with the latest operating system on the Mac. They've got integration with Samsung's latest Galaxy S5 phone. So it shows that they're willing to play with others, and I guess that kind of positions themselves as a company that networks, which is what they're really all about.
Now, Alexis Madrigal, what do you do with your business cards? I'm kind of curious about this because it's such a spectacularly antiquated practice to exchange little slabs of tree pulp when you meet somebody. What do you do with yours?
Yeah, well, the main thing that I do is people say, hey, can I have your business card? And for whatever reason, every single time, even though I know I don't have any business cards on me, I sort of pat, you know, that my front pockets like, oh, I forgot them again, you know, because there's still an expectation that you're going to have them on you, even when you're people like us who it's much easier to connect with us through Twitter, through something else, through some other medium than it is to, you know, take a business card and you know, call their work phone number or something. I think, you know, the most interesting thing for me about the story is just trying to think about what LinkedIn's going to become, especially like putting it in the context of their sort of media efforts. I mean, they're not going to be a technology company that focuses on this sort of thing, on bringing your sort of real life interactions and business cards into their network, but they're increasingly expanding their efforts into becoming more of this sort of content distribution network. And I guess I just never am totally quite sure what LinkedIn thinks it is. I mean, there was a little tidbit I saw recently, you know, where if you're logged in and you come across somebody that you're not connected to, it won't give you their last name, but if you log out, it'll give you their last name. And it's just another one of those things where you're sort of like, I can't quite put my finger on it, but I feel like the LinkedIn strategy is just confusing to me as a general proposition.
And it's confusing to me as well. And even more confusing is the fact that no company has stepped up with the right solution for essentially what is one of the most important things that people do with computers and smartphones, which is maintain their contact database. There's all this emphasis on social networks. Of course, social networks, you know, your database of contacts, that's the original social network. And there's got to be some way for some company to do most of, you know, what LinkedIn is doing and more. What LinkedIn does and what's great about LinkedIn as a contact database is that the people who own the information, the people in your contact database, maintain their own information. So if you, for example, if we're connected on LinkedIn and you change your phone number, I can forget about it for 6 months, and if I want to call you, I go in there and it's your new phone number. It's not the old one that I got when I last encountered your phone number. And that's the kind of thing that everybody should be trying to do. Google should be doing this. Facebook should be trying to do this. I don't know where Google is with this stuff. Their contacts site is a disaster. It's horrible performance. It's really antiquated. So I'm hoping that LinkedIn will take this initiative and lurch forward in the future and provide something that, in addition to business cards, is a real you know, contact database solution that we can really use and that is, you know, sort of updated and maintained, because the world desperately needs this. Now, Zach Hall, LinkedIn has a really kind of a weird social attribute to it. It's kind of trying to be a social network. Does this partnership and the business card feature, and also the other partnerships, for example, they had a partnership with Post-it Notes with 3M. They had a partnership with Moleskine where you could, you know, take pictures of your doodles and it would go into your Evernote database and stuff like this. Do any of these things have a social component, for example, especially for LinkedIn? When LinkedIn, for example, if I import somebody's contact information, do I automatically subscribe to their LinkedIn social feed?
Well, that's kind of the, I think the idea is that it's like the professional social network. And just for example, for me, I mean, I've got two contacts for myself in my iCloud contact database. One for, you know, my birthday, home address, all that, and then one for professional, you know, without my phone number, but with my email address and a Twitter account. And LinkedIn tried to do something kind of like that with a service called Intro earlier this year that was pulled pretty quickly, where it would kind of let you hack your way into getting your LinkedIn contacts to integrate with your native contacts app on iOS. And it was really, it was weird to trust it like that. You had to give it some weird permissions. But that's the goal. And I think if they can do what they did, like with the Galaxy S5, which is have like built-in integration, and also what they have with Mac OS X, if they can do that, you know, on every version of Android, if they can do that on iOS, then they can kind of become that plug into your existing contacts app and have that information updated without you having to worry about it.
Now, Web8931 in the chat room is telling us that Joanna Stern wrote a good article in the Wall Street Journal. Sounds like an opinion column about how there are no good electronic substitutes for business cards. I haven't read it, but it's being recommended by, you know, Web8931, so it must be true. So
right, it is a good article, and she said as of recently as today that since she wrote that article, that a lot of startups that are tackling this problem or trying to have reached out to her. So it's not just LinkedIn trying to do this or others. It's, you know, people are trying to go at it from the bottom up.
I mean, in a funny way, it actually sort of highlights why paper is so good as a technology in some ways, right? Because right, everybody can read it. You know, it's 100% of the people that you can give a business card to can see what's on it.
Yeah, that's interesting that there's, I mean, there is a standard file format for contact information, but there's not a standard service that really connects it across. And it seems like it could be easy to fix, but it's just, it hasn't been yet.
So. Totally.
Well, Zach Hall, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
All right, you can find Zach Hall at 95mac.com, also 95google.com, and on Twitter at APOLLOZAC.
That's right, thanks.
Thanks again. In a sec, we're going to tell you about a new music service. Yeah, that's right, the world needs another music service. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace. Squarespace is the place to build a website on the internet. Of course, if you do build a website, you should build it on the internet. That's the best place for a website. But the best place to build it is Squarespace.com. They have 25 beautiful templates for you to start with, and they've recently added a logo creator tool. That's right. If you have a small business or need a logo for any reason, you can just go in there, use their logo creator tool, and create a very professional-looking logo very easily without, if you're like me and have zero talent for design, this is perfect. You can still do it because they have such good tools for building logos. Squarespace as a website creation and hosting platform is incredibly, incredibly easy to use. You won't believe how easy it is. So easy to use that it's actually super fun to use, even if you don't have any real intention of building a real website. I go in there sometimes just create websites just to see what if I had a website that looked like this? What if I had one that looked like that? It's a lot of fun. It's a source of entertainment because it's so fun. And of course, if you have any questions or need any help at all, Squarespace has live chat and email support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it's very good support. They also have e-commerce for all subscription levels. That means you can sell things or accept money for your nonprofit or your cash wedding registry or your school fund drive or whatever it is that you want to raise money for. And of course, it's great for small businesses for selling things on the internet. And Squarespace is inexpensive. It starts at only $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT and that'll get you 10% off and also show your support for Tech News Today. And we thank Squarespace for their support of this program. And remember that a better web awaits and it starts with your new Squarespace website. Well, the Silicon Valley-based TuneIn, which is an internet radio service, relaunches today. The site now combines global radio stations and internet radio stations with social networking and much better search and site navigation. Tom Cheridar is a staff writer for VentureBeat, and he wrote a really good article about this, and he's here to tell us all about it. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad to have you here. Now, isn't combining music with social what sort of doomed Apple's Ping service? I mean, do people want to be social with their music, especially with their internet radio music?
I mean, Spotify is built off of being a social music platform. It might not be the most social, but I think I even saw like the latest commercials that are running on Hulu and a few other places. And they're really long and obnoxious and awful, but they plug social. So, yeah, I think so.
You mentioned Spotify. Can the radio model compete against the Spotify type services? I mean, this is essentially aggregating all kinds of sources of radio, and most of it is terrestrial radio that's also streamed on the internet, right? So is this a model that can compete even if it's a super great service?
I mean, the thing that always gets me about talking about terrestrial stations is all of these stations have been around for a while. They've survived like the new media age and having to shift and change and compete with the cooler, shinier digital services. They're businesses that have been around a long time and have managed to survive. So not all of them are great, and some of them are owned by big conglomerates now, but they're still pretty tenacious businesses. So I think they're going to be around a while. And if somebody can figure out, like TuneIn's doing, and pull all that together and make it searchable, which they've done, that was what the service was before, and now they're trying to add that social layer. They've got a decent shot for the people who don't like, Pandora because they feel like it's just glorified Muzak and don't want to mess with Spotify because there's too many choices, maybe, even if they've got their own radio service. So I think there's a lot of potential here, and they're doing it in a different way than what the majority of other big streaming music competitors are doing. So
now, of course, Twit fans can listen to Twit's live stream, the audio version of Twit's live stream, on this service. And, of course, you can share it with your friends. You can comment. I added a comment this morning on the Twit feed, but one of the interesting things about it is you can, of course, follow stations, and these are, internet streaming stations like Twit and also terrestrial radio, as we mentioned. And that's a little awkward, the terrestrial radio, because a lot of that is advertising supported, and this service is advertising supported. So you're getting ads from both the radio stations,
yeah,
and they're local ads. You know, it's like, you get a Brazilian samba station, and you're getting ads for a local Brazilian, mm-hmm, feijoada joint or something.
Whatever.
It's like, what am I going to do with that? So, but the other thing that's interesting is you can, in addition to following stations, you can follow people. So those of you out there who want to follow Twit on the service, you can also follow me as a person who is cultivating stations. And that's kind of a cool thing. I can see, theoretically, if this thing takes off, stars emerging, people who are really good at picking internet radio stations.
I mean, it's that. It's also, when I talked to TuneIn about this, they really looked at it as a potential way to open up the communication, the lines of communication with the audience that radio basically was not able to get at. They were using like Twitter or Facebook and all these other services. And the biggest thing they pointed out is they have a larger number of favorites, which have been converted into follows, than Twitter for most of these local college radio stations. So now now they can actually go through, not have to mess with the noise of Twitter, and just talk to their fans with a platform that's just been built for them. So it's got potential. I mean, people have to like it. So that'll be the true test. People don't use it.
I think it's like really, it's kind of nice in uniting the different ways that you can do radio station discovery. I mean, I think for me, like, my major problem is just not being able to actually figure out which ones I might want to listen to. And so, you combine the searchability with the social signals, and maybe that sort of is enough to make it easy for someone like me who, wouldn't mind tuning into some college radio station to listen to whatever. But also, I'm not really going to go out of my way to like track that down.
Yeah. I didn't put this in the article, but I think that what they've set up, this kind of social feed, it could be like the replacement for people who are constantly messing with the radio dial in their car, or I guess they're more mm-hmm. buttons now. Because, people fidget and they want to find something. I don't like this song, but it's tolerable. Let me see what else is on.
Yeah.
So if you can flick on your phone, I could see that as being something, especially as, in car dash radio systems start to support services like TuneIn.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Tom Cheridar, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, you can find Tom Cheridar at venturebeat.com and on Twitter at tched. That's TCHED. Well, the Chinese giant Alibaba filed paperwork yesterday to become a publicly traded stock in the United States. Mark Million is a tech writer for Bloomberg. He's written about this story, and he's here to tell us all about Alibaba and this strange story of a gigantic company hardly anyone has heard of. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, Mike.
What's up, Mark?
Now, of course, I say hardly anybody's heard of. In China, they've definitely heard of it. In the U.S., most U.S. consumers are unfamiliar with it, even though it's one of the world's largest tech companies, significantly bigger than most of the big U.S. tech companies. Can you tell us what kind of businesses Alibaba is in, Mark?
Oh, yeah. Alibaba is absolutely a beast. It's been often called the Amazon of China because it's by far the biggest e-commerce online shopping service in the country. They have something like 231 million people who use it on a regular basis. They buy on average 49 orders from this website per year. And they spend $248 billion buying everything from, food, which is the most popular category of things to buy there because food safety is a big issue in China, to electronics and iPads, to forklifts. You'll find some small businesses buying massive machines and automobiles on this website. But that's not all they do. They have this Taobao marketplace, which is the largest service, which is more of like a B2B sort of thing where you'll find some of these forklifts. And it's mainly like small sellers, kind of like an eBay. They also do auctions. And then there's Tmall, which is more like the Amazon service you might know. But then they're in a bunch of other things, like they've got an Amazon Web Services type business. They also have a music streaming service, and they've more recently gotten into basically being a UPS for China. They want to be able to deliver packages 24 hours a day to anywhere in China. They're just an insane, insane conglomerate in the biggest internet market in the world, and now they're starting to look elsewhere, and this IPO in the U.S. is the first step there.
Now, you compared them to Amazon, and that's probably a handy way for U.S. consumers to understand what they do, even if it's a little bit not exactly what they do. But in a couple of respects, they are the opposite of Amazon. For example, Amazon is famous for plowing all of their profits back into the company, so their profit margin is very low. They have razor-thin profits on purpose because they're trying to undercut competitors with lower prices and that sort of thing. Alibaba is massively profitable, profit margin of roughly 45%. And in fact, in 2013, they made a profit of $3.56 billion on revenue of $7.95 billion. That's enormous profit margin, and that's going to really get the attention of stockholders who want to invest in this company. How do they make such high profits, especially in a country like China where pricing is such a sensitive issue?
Yeah, their main business, Taobao Marketplace, is more of like an eBay in the respect that it just facilitates companies to sell their goods to other businesses that need sort of high-end equipment or to consumers. And then Alibaba takes a cut of those transactions. So it's not their main business isn't so much like Amazon where they will do, you know, manage their own product inventory and drive down the cost so they can be cheaper than Walmart. And the flip side of that is for hundreds of millions of Chinese, there is no Walmart and there is no sort of corner store where they can get everything they might need, including, like I mentioned before, sort of clean food. So Alibaba, for the vast majority of China's cities, is basically the only option. So they can sort of drive up prices on certain items to the extent that there's very little competition because nobody really has the breadth of Alibaba in China.
Now, one of the most interesting things about this story is the founder of Alibaba, whose name is Jack Ma. He's the biggest shareholder, and the company is structured to maintain enormous dictatorial powers in his personal hands. And that's something that gives some stockholders pause. But what do you know about Jack Ma? Where did he come from, and what is his story broadly?
He's a pretty wild dude. I think he failed his college finals like twice and had to retake them, and so he was not. He didn't drop out like a lot of your Silicon Valley executives did, but he did. His challenges in school are well known. He's a fan of the martial arts. At his going away ceremony for Alibaba, he stepped down last year or the year before. He sang a song and danced around in front of thousands of employees. But he's really sort of this guiding force. He's almost a Steve Jobsian type figure within China. He's this huge personality there. He exerts a lot of control over the company, as evidenced by this structure that you were referencing, where some longtime managers at the company and at affiliated companies were given the rights to essentially appoint who the board members will be, basically cutting shareholders out of that voting process for the most part.
Well, let this be a lesson to all the kids out there. You don't have to drop out of college to become an internet billionaire. You can stay in college and get horrible grades and still make it to the top. So, Mark Million, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. You can find Mark Million at Bloomberg.com and also on Twitter at Mark Million. That's Million, M-I-L-I-A-N. Google today bought a website called Appitas, which exists for restaurants to build websites for themselves to integrate restaurant services like OpenTable and Grubhub. Google plans to shut Appitas down. Existing users will be moved to another service, unnamed, probably Google Plus Local and Google Maps, which have already been integrated with Google's previous acquisition of Zagat. Alexis Madrigal, the consolidation in this industry of hospitality, I guess you could call it, is really heating up. And we have another story coming up in just a second. But this is a case in which Google is aggressively buying a pretty major company and essentially grabbing the people, grabbing the customers, and then shutting the company down. Are we going to see a lot more of these, you think?
Gosh, I don't know. I hope that somebody comes up with a way of having restaurant websites that aren't terrible. I mean, I think just like was it Farhad? Somebody, the year before, kind of went off on a tirade that basically restaurant websites are really bad. What you want to know is when they're open, what's on the menu, if the menu changes a lot, and like maybe secondarily, reviews for that restaurant or these other kinds of things. And like to date, just so many restaurant websites are so bad that the best thing they do is basically put the menu online in like a PDF format. And like that's considered to be like best practice. So if, various players in this space can create a way that you can make reservations, see the menu easily and all that kind of stuff, I think it'd be a welcome development.
And I hope so, especially from Google. I mean, one of the things is restaurant discovery. And who knows if a restaurant is good or not? I mean, you have to go and look at to Yelp or whatever. And Google wants to replace Yelp as the place where you go to find out if a restaurant is good or not. They've got a long way to go there. But, you want to be walking down the street and have something notify you and say, hey, I know you like a certain type of food. This restaurant has that kind of food. It's highly rated and a couple of your friends like it as well. That sort of thing. Everybody keeps promising or threatening that sort of thing and nobody's really delivered on it. And I think Google would probably like to, and this may be part of that. So hopefully they can get this together. Now, this company is pretty new. It was founded in 2012, and it's based in Seattle. The company's going to stay there, but they're going to, of course, work for Google. Well, in a related story, the Open Table of Europe, which is a French company called La Fourchette, has been acquired by TripAdvisor. This is part of the consolidation that we talked about in the market for hospitality. Now, this company has restaurants based partners in France, Spain, and Switzerland. That's really where it mostly operates. They have more than 12,000 restaurant partners, and it's probably an $140 million all cash deal. And again, this is I don't know if you've ever used this Alexis Madrigal, but they're called La Fourchette in French, El Tenedor in Spanish, and The Fork in English. I've never used them before. I don't even think I've heard of them before, but they're a pretty major company.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an avid OpenTable user. I think it makes a ton of sense that restaurant reservation systems would work this way. You know, to me, it's not really very exciting business. Like, it's basically a reservations front end, and then you have to go like retail it out and find ways to hook into all these various restaurant systems by like going out to them. I mean, it's kind of Groupon-y in that way. And I just find it like these kinds of things. I mean, I wouldn't want to be in that business, but I'm glad somebody is, you know?
Yeah. And I think the biggest feature that I want personally is the ability to order things and also pay without dealing with a server. I mean, they call them waiters, but I'm the one who's always waiting, especially to pay to leave. This whole thing where you wait for the bill, then the credit card goes back there in the back, your credit card with the, you know, little number on the back, and everything goes vanishes, and then they come back, and then you have to sign it, and then you know, the whole thing is a mess. I just want to push a button. I wanted to know what I ordered, push a button, pay for it, and waltz out of there without having to wait. Of course, I'm probably more impatient than the average restaurant goer. But
have you tried? I mean, there's some solutions they're trying to. Some of them companies trying to provide solutions around this. But it actually turns out, at least in my experience, you know, you order on some little ruggedized tablet, and then you try to get everything correct. It actually turns out it's like pretty hard. There's a restaurant in Palo Alto that you know Steve Jobs used to frequent, and is you know kind of a place where people go, the name of which is escaping me at the moment, but they've tried to build in this kind of system, and it seems like it should be easy. It seems like there aren't all these complexities, but when you actually try and execute that system, it turns out that it's not that easy.
Yeah. Well, hopefully somebody will solve that problem. Well, we got a question in our Google Plus community from a user by the unlikely name of Mal Disposto. I don't think that's his real name. And this, again, is on our Google Plus community. And here's the question. Quote, why do we have journalists on Tech News Today and not representatives from the companies or products in the news? Now, this is similar to the question somebody asked yesterday after the show was over, and I answered it, but we didn't put it into the show. So I thank you, Mr. Disposto, for asking this question again, and I'm going to answer it again, this time on the recorded version of the show. We're unique or very unusual in the sense that we always have journalists, and not just any journalists. We work hard to find the journalists who are putting out the best stories, oftentimes exclusives, oftentimes the best explanatory journalism that we can find, and there's a good reason for that. We hear a lot from the original sources, meaning the people in the marketing departments or the CEOs or the companies that are trying to sell you something. We've heard their perspective. We know that a company likes itself and wants you to buy its product. What's often lacking is an appreciation for super high quality journalism. The truth is, the ugly truth is that in the world of technology journalism, there's an echo chamber, meaning that a couple of really great journalists put together really great stories, and then there are hundreds of people oftentimes of just Me Too journalism. They're essentially writing their story off the original journalism. And people oftentimes don't appreciate the difference between great journalism and mediocre journalism. And so what we do is we go hunt down the people who are breaking the news, who are delivering the exclusives, who are bringing out information, who directly interviewed multiple sources and have spent some time thinking about how to articulate the facts in this case. We bring them on when it's fresh. Oftentimes the articles we talk about just hit within the last hour or two before the show starts, and it's top of their mind. And these are really, in my opinion, the best people to talk to if you want to get the real facts in the story and the relevant facts explained in a way that makes the most sense. And that's why we do that in Tech News Today. We bring on the best journalists we can find to explain the stories that they wrote about the news of the day. And as you can see, this really works. Oftentimes, in every case, I'm sure there are facts that are relevant or even opinions or viewpoints did not appear in the original story, which we can sometimes extract out of our guests. For example, Tom Cheradar mentioned all kinds of ideas and information that he actually said were not in his article. They weren't in anybody's article, but you got it here on Tech News Today because we brought him on and let him speak for himself in his own words. And again, this is our model. We love this model, and we think it works really great. And it's really been resonating with a lot of listeners and viewers. And so I thank you, Mal, for that question, and that's why we do what we do. Well, in other news, LG started today selling home appliances that you can talk to using a chat app on your smartphone. The appliances include a refrigerator, a washing machine, and a microwave oven. The app works like any other chat app, like WhatsApp or whatever, but you're actually talking to the appliances, not another person. For example, you can ask the fridge if there's any milk, and it will tell you, yeah, there's a carton of milk in the fridge. The washing machine can change its schedule with a simple request via this chat app, and the fridge even has a camera inside, so it can send you a picture of its contents. You can also find out if the light goes off when you close the door. Sadly, the appliances are available only in Korea for now, but LG says they'll sell them in other countries in the future, including specifically the United States of America. Alexis Madrigal, would you buy a smart fridge that you could chat with?
Sure. If I, you know, the price was the same. I mean, I guess I find myself a skeptic about home automation. So many of these things seem so cool, but like they're, when you actually think about how many times you want to ask your refrigerator a question, it's actually not very many times. And when you think about how many times you want to ask your refrigerator a question when you're not standing in front of the refrigerator, it's an even smaller number of times. And so while I find these things exciting, I think the intelligence that we hope that they have is almost always less than what they actually have. And I think that ends up being disappointing. And I'll give one just short example. You know, I have Nest thermostats. I think they're beautiful. I like them just as an object, and I'm not sad about having purchased them. On the other hand, you know, they describe it as this sort of learning algorithm, you know, that you're going to have this thermostat that is going to sort of figure out what your schedule is and turn up the heat and turn it down and all this kind of stuff. And like, that just never happened in my case. It's just not one intelligent decision was ever made by the Nest thermostat. And, you know, maybe that will improve in the future. Maybe the refrigerators from LG will be smarter than the Nest. But these things are actually quite hard data problems, I think. And most of the time, you can do better just opening the frigging fridge yourself, you know?
Absolutely. And I think the tension is that you want automation, you want convenience, but you also don't want control wrested from you. You don't want to feel like your house is out of control. And this can often happen when the temperature's going crazy and the fridge won't shut up and stop texting you, whatever. I mean, it's like we want control. That's the main thing. Like right now I can control my fridge. I talk to my refrigerator all the time. It never answers me. It can be so cold sometimes. But, you know, we want control, and we also want some automation, but they're going to have to make sure that they don't take away the control when they give us the convenience. So I think that's really the tension with not only smart appliances, but the Internet of Things in general and home automation in particular. Well, Alexis Madrigal, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today. Again, I'm a big fan of your work and your writing and your career, and I'm really thrilled to have you on today.
Absolutely. Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. You can subscribe to Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT. You can also find us on that radio app we told you about. We want to hear from you. We want to hear your views and comments and maybe read them on the air. Just comment on Twitter or Google+ using the hashtag Tech News Today and send us an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us voicemail by calling 260-TNT Show. Also, don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.